Hello and welcome to Out of the Frame, conversations about photography. I'm Pia Johnson, your host, and this podcast features conversations about photography, creativity, and the world we live in. I'll be talking to other photographers, curators, academics, and researchers about their work, artistic process, and how they feel about contemporary photography today. Out of the Frame acknowledges the people of the Woiwurrung and Boonwurrung language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nation, on whose unceded lands we record each episode from. We respectfully acknowledge ancestors and elders, past and present. It was, and always will be, Aboriginal land.
My guest today is Dr. Kirsten Garner-Little, who is a Maori Australian academic and creative practice led researcher. She is an inaugural postdoctorate research fellow at Monash University's Wamanjeka Jimbana Indigenous Research Lab, where her work focuses on the intersection of photography and customary Maori art practices. Her work has been exhibited widely, including Melbourne Now at the National Gallery and the Tarawarra Biennial in 2023. She was awarded Monash's Dean's Early Career Researcher of the Year in 2024, and her writing appears in Routledge, ACCA Art in Australia, and the Journal of Visual Art Practice. With over a decade of teaching experience, she has taught at RMIT, BCA, Deakin, Photography Studies College, and Monash. She regularly presents on the intersections of photography and Indigenous methodologies at national and international forums, including Photo 2024 and the Tate Gallery's Country Informing Practice Symposium, also in 2024. This year, in September, Kirsten was able to take a funded artist residency at Bundanong.
Hi, Kirsten. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me here. I'm excited to be here.
I'm really excited to be here too. I thought we'd just get straight in and see or hear from you how you got into photography and what your interests are within your early days of photography.
Okay. I came to photography from a slightly different angle. I was a philosopher before I was a photographer. And then
deep respect.
Oh, thank you. So, yeah, oddly, both very unemployable at times. But, going to from philosophy to then art school, but started in philosophy, was doing my master's and looking to become an academic and maybe do my PhD in philosophy, and was involved in a bad car accident. And it sort of redirected my focus a bit. So I, was fairly disabled for quite a while and had mobility issues. And the thing that I had always been interested in was art, and art had always kind of saved me. And I love the fact that so much of making art is about problem solving, and it engages so much of your brain. And so I kind of lost my job. I was fairly miserable, and I just thought, if not now, when? And kind of decided to go to art school.
Wow.
So I started from the bottom and went through TAFE. And while playing with all sorts of medium, I had a disability at the time, and photography was one thing that I could control physically a lot better than things like printmaking, where there was so much
standing.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would build dioramas and photograph them. So that's where I started from, where it was all based from my chair, I guess. Yeah.
Wow, that's really amazing. Like, in terms of also the constraints, and I imagine a lot of pain also during that period, to think about your perspective through that, but also the fact that you had the material of the diorama.
Yes.
And then to the 3D, moving into the 2D.
Yeah. So it was something I could sit at my desk. It was also I had researched really heavily, so I could kind of use my researcher brain into recreating historical representations of Maori people, photograph them. I had little controls and little sets, and then when I learnt more about photography, I looked at some of people like Gregory Crutzen and his early work, where it was diorama based.
Totally.
Before he got
before the movie set.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Which makes so much sense. So I think sometimes when you're limited with materials, whether it's financially or physically or whatever, sometimes it can really push your practice.
Yeah. I also really respect that you've identified the researcher brain, because I think that also brings a different criticality to the making process and the like, I need to express myself, but how can I do it within this inner context of writers, thinkers, makers, artists, whatever it might be. And so having that engagement I think also is a really instrumental way of translating the information.
Yes.
Like, you know, like whatever story or, you know, thing that you're wanting to say. And it sounds probably really academic, but again, when you've got the constraints and the limitations, if you can go there in your head, right, and you can draw from all those different references and different visual languages, it just becomes this really rich playground, even though you're constrained.
Yeah, and it's that thing too of I've always, I hate it when you hear people talking about, you know, concepts and they make it hard to understand or hard to follow, and you kind of get lost in all the isms and ologies and all that sort of stuff. The smartest people I've always met have been able to concisely take something that's incredibly complicated and reduce it down so that anyone can understand it. And I think for me, some of art making is visually expressing some really complicated ideas in a way that people can look at and get it.
Yeah, really quickly.
Yeah.
But also I feel like the really good pieces of work, I sometimes think, you know, of classical music sometimes where it's like it just gets right in first.
Yes.
And you feel it before you even really understand what you're feeling.
Yeah.
And really great pieces of artwork that can be super complex, but they get you.
Yeah.
Right?
And then you see how complicated they are. The
and
more
then
you read
unfold.
About them, you go, oh, wow. And there's these layers and depth of yeah, I love that when art engages your brain and stays in your brain and your visual memory for a long time and you keep thinking about it.
Yeah, and there's a lot of skill in that, don't you think?
Oh, massively.
Like, but I really agree with you. I feel like it's really easy to perform the jargon.
Yeah, completely.
Right, and perform that role.
Yep.
But actually being able to articulate self so that everyone can understand is the kind of, especially in education too, right? Like the higher goal, and they're the people that are really smart and that really engaged. And, there seems to be a clarity or a purpose, I think, in terms of that kind of work, whether it is in a lecture or a artwork. And I think photography is so coded anyway, right?
Definitely.
Like it's a, you know, it's a colonial tool. It's as we know, very deeply problematic. The language that's used around it is weaponized.
And masculine.
And masculine, right? Yeah. And so, again, how do we find ways to hack that in a way?
Yeah.
Still make something that's evocative and intelligent but is accessible too.
Definitely. I know I was with I recently just came back from Bundanon having an artist residency with a collective of women who I work with who are photographers and researchers and an art historian. And being with three women or four women altogether, but kind of sharing food and time and making work. And we'd sort of had that conversation about photography being so classically masculine and the language of photography, whether it's shoot or capture, stuff about lenses. And I related a story that I had seen someone, I think it was called Kate Golding actually, talking about, and she had a women photographers group, and rather than talking about lenses and photography and it all being very male and phallic, that it was actually more like the aperture of a camera was more like a cervix. So as women, we should reclaim it. And I always thought that was really brilliant.
It's very clever.
It's very clever.
I hadn't thought that. Yeah. Big fan of Kate's too. That's made me really think, actually.
Yeah.
I love it.
Well, when I was away, I was telling my collective and they were like, oh, that's amazing.
That's rich, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a lovely image too.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there's also a rise in like kind of cameraless photography at the moment, and that's being seen as more grounded, in place, feminine, material. But actually, if we go back to the aperture, what a great, great thing.
Isn't
that's like, I'm going to really think about that for a while.
Yeah, I wish I could claim it, but I heard it from Kate.
I think the other thing I'd be interested in talking about with that early work, and it, you know, it's very much, I think, why I've bonded with your work is the self-expression of your cultural identity and background and negotiating that again within the kind of photographic realm. Because it is, I think, when you're coming from a non-white perspective or like for me, the Eurasian, where it feels very confused a lot of the time, there's another set of propositions that are sitting underneath it that you're trying to communicate. So could you talk a little bit about that and how you, I guess, tackle that within your work?
Yeah. So I really first started making work that had ideas about identity in it because I'm someone who is mixed race and adopted. So there were sort of multiple layers of confusion with it. And so my heritage is Māori, but I was adopted by a Pākehā, a white family, but grew up in New Zealand and in Australia sort of simultaneously. So I was born in Sydney, moved to Aotearoa, New Zealand when I was 4, came back to Melbourne at 8.
So, oh, my gosh.
So I guess for me when I was at art school, I was kind of really interested to go, wow, I've got a university library, which was exciting.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I want to look up, like I would look up Māori. I still do it on the Google and look, and just see what comes up. And what I was shocked at was how at the time there were about, and this is a while ago, but there were only about 3 books on Māori in RMIT library where I studied at the time.
Wow.
It's changed now. There's a lot more now. But then,
but still, when you look at those, I think I had a conversation with Lisa Healy recently. There's a big new women photographers, you know, retrospective book out. We couldn't find a Pacific woman.
Oh,
in it.
That'd be right.
Right? Yeah. Like, yeah, just insane. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was sort of, they were all written by non-Māori researchers.
Mm.
One was on Māori art that only looked at customary art. So it's almost as though there have been no contemporary Māori artists.
Ridiculous.
Which is frustrating. Yeah. And then there was another one that was made in the 60s. That had photographs of Māori women in customary clothing, and it almost had a soft porn aesthetic.
Oh no!
They were doing the model thing, but there was a bit of leg showing. Yeah,
bit of cleavage,
bit of a cheeky smile, and I was just horrified that this was an anthropology book.
No,
made in the 1960s. So
wow.
Yeah, and they were often set in really fake.
Yeah, they do the fake background, right? Like the artificial background. Yeah. It's interesting you say that because I didn't realize it did the same thing because obviously they do that with, you know, in inverted commas, oriental.
Oh, yes, of course.
You know, the exotic. But that's it's the same language, isn't it?
Yeah, we were noble savages. So, yeah, it was that similar kind of label of the Pacific, especially Polynesian.
Mm.
So it seems so Polynesian being Māori, Cook Islands, Samoan, Tongan. Especially seem to be fetishized.
And women in particular, right? It's that, you know, sexual innuendo. Yeah.
And even when you look at tourist, which you can still buy in New Zealand today, at the airport you can still buy Māori dolls.
No.
Yeah. And the women, like you'll get the male version and then the female version and they're both in the little traditional outfits, the women are always slightly paler skinned.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, because that way you can go, oh, she's cute. Because, you know, if anyone is seen as darker, it's seen as less attractive. So the men are allowed, the male dolls are allowed to be dark.
Wow.
I don't
understand.
I know, it's so
I really
weird.
Don't
it's
understand.
So weird. But you literally see
you can put them
side
politics in the doll.
In the doll, yeah.
Wow. And I imagine the really short little
skirt.
And all of the things. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm going to jump to very recently because you were able to do a guest keynote for a symposium that I co-curated with a couple of other colleagues here, and you have been doing some research into archives, and I'd love for you to share just really briefly a photograph, I think, just speaking to that 1960s, but going way back to, what was it, 1890s or something like that? Or
1840s.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Wow. Even further back. About how the classification, also because we've got white people identifying incorrectly cultural. So, like, they've set it up in a artificial studio. They've used cultural items, but they are then misclassified by contemporary historians now. Yes.
So there is a daguerreotype that was rediscovered in 2020 by two researchers at ANU, Martin Jolly and Eliza De Corsi, and they happened through their other research on imperial photographs of the time, and they came across this and it had been misclassified and sitting in the Australian National Library archives. They didn't know what it was. These ANU researchers found it, discovered it, brought it to light, and it's now believed to be the earliest image of a Māori person that we're aware of.
Wow.
So it is still in Australian collections, which is problematic.
Totally.
And the catalogue item, like if you go online and have a look at this photo, so it's of a guy called, he was a teenager at the time, Hemi Pormarie, and Hemi had been picked up by, he'd basically been traded like a human commodity and taken to London where this daguerreotype was taken, and he was traded. He was shown as a human display who sat in the Egyptian Hall in London, surrounded like by
Tarzan
artifacts.
Right?
Yeah. He'd sit in a hall all day to be gawked at with, you know, other items that had been collected on the way, including watercolours and artifacts, and he just sat in a chair all day.
Awful.
Yeah. So this photograph is taken during that time. We know he was a teenager. He roughly they age him somewhere 13 to 15 at the time. And he was photographed in London in a photographer's studio. He's standing next to a chair and there's a you can see a European
cravat or something, right? Yeah.
Underneath his cloak. But he's wearing two cloaks. The catalogue description describes it as he's wearing a korowai, which is a specific type of cloak, a korowai. And almost every Māori weaver will know this. A korowai has tassels.
Yeah.
It's part of the design of a korowai. There are no tassels anywhere. And, in fact, he's not wearing one cloak. He's wearing two. And they've been arranged to they're worn in a way that would never be worn.
I was going to say, they have been that photographer has gone, oh, we're going to use this and this.
Yeah,
and
that looks good.
That looks good and put it on that body.
Yeah, oh, we'll show both of them. It looks great, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll just wrap up.
And over Western
clothing. Western clothing. And to me, I find it appalling that contemporary researchers are not asking customary makers or descendants. It does seem that they have done some research and they did talk to people in at the Auckland Museum. But again, the museum isn't always the experts. It's often the community.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that, again, through art practice and through making, we can constantly, I guess, render visible the gaps, you know, the people that aren't there or the mistakes that are within those institutions. Because they are, I mean, I love a museum, I love a library, I love an archive, but it's bias is always present. They're not always spaces that are inviting or belonging to non-white bodies or disabled bodies. Like any, you know, the access is always a kind of big hiccup that they don't acknowledge. But also at that really high expertise level, you would think, right, that you'd kind of go, especially in this day and age, it's not like there aren't community that are alive and well or working within or contemporary artists that are conversing in.
There are so many. I found the name of the cloak that he was wearing, like the type and the style, really quickly. And even on a 2018 blog from Te Papa, which is New Zealand's National Library, National Museum, there is a blog post about when a korowai is not a korowai, and that's 2018. Like, it's easy to find this stuff out.
Yeah, so it's just a bit of lazy work.
Really. I think so, yeah.
Which is just so sad. And I think it is a really good example, and I think that's part of the reason why you brought it up and the ideas of kind of looking back and looking forward. We have to get better at this stuff.
Definitely. Yeah.
And actually, you know, we need to celebrate it, but we also need to find out where, like, the authentic stories lie and the facts behind it. And as you say, it's not a hard ask. It's not a big ask.
No.
Yeah.
It's a couple of conversations often.
Yeah, which is really worrying, I think. And especially in that research world, right?
Yeah,
I mean, just, yeah.
Well, so, I always found it really interesting with the Australian Museum in Sydney. They were taking, to find out provenance of some of their Pacific belongings. They knew that the communities who had the information didn't feel comfortable in their spaces. So what they would do is pack up customary subjects, I won't call them objects, but ancestral belongings, and take them to where the community was, which was rugby games. And they would set them
up. Oh, my gosh, that is super cool.
It's clever, isn't it? And they've been doing that for some time to find out information about it. So take it to the community. Don't expect always. And I think there needs to be, in a lot of these institutions, especially around archives, there's a preciousness of they're like, but it's ours and you can't touch it and you've got a digitised version, you don't need the real thing, or you don't need the physical connection with these ancestors. But I think because they are ancestors, they need their own people in there.
Yeah, amazing. I think that's a really, really important point, but also to that physical going back to a community, I think, is so important.
Yeah.
And it's significant in terms of what the offering is. It's talking about care. It's talking about context.
Yeah.
It's saying we understand and we're going to respect the forums of which we then hold those belongings.
And they learnt. They found
out.
Well,
they would have learnt so much,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Because you get an auntie going, oh, yeah, that's a thingy and that's used for this.
Yeah. Like it was just, you know, used yesterday.
Yeah.
Because
exactly.
That's how, yeah. I also think there is an important sending of story that a lot of the time museums don't have the story aspect. And I guess I was working with the Immigration Museum, an incredible curator there, Moya McFadgen, who as part of her collecting process writes down and records the stories for each and stays in linking and in conversation with the families that are donating the work. So it's just like ultimate respect.
That's,
integrity for the materials and the whether they're written or is it artifacts or family history, so that when I, as the outsider, came in and asked, what's this photo or what's this document, she then could actually relay me
that
individual story.
Yeah.
You know, and brought to life all these other things that aren't necessarily on the digitized museum neat little catalogue item.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think that has to be noted and, I guess, encouraged more in terms of these practices. Because they are living archives.
They are, and they need, I think there's something, like I've talked a little in the past, and I think at your symposium too, about the example of Te Rā, which is the last Māori sail that is in the collection of the British Museum, and that had the latest technology applied to it to study it. It's had photogeometry and all sorts of complicated stuff done to it, but the only way it could be completely unpacked in how it was made was by being reverse engineered by Māori weavers, who are also academics, but and textile experts. So they reverse engineered it and remade it, and that's how they learnt
how it was actually constructed.
Made. Yeah, and they couldn't have figured that out without these amazing Māori weavers. So there's something about needing to physically see it, to touch it, to have
understand
some
the
kind of haptic connection, and I think. It irritates me that when photographs are treated as different because they have this ability to be endlessly produced, there's the idea that, oh, well, you don't need to have a haptic connection. But I would argue you do, because that's still the ancestor And then there are questions about where, you know, if these are our ancestors, and many Indigenous communities, I know the Māori community, treat them as though they are a living ancestor. Mm. What does that mean for if they're being digitized? What does that mean about where
totally.
They're being stored?
And their spirit and all of yeah. the things that and are what, compromised in
where
that.
Where is their cloud storage? Are you storing ancestors somewhere overseas away from their own country? How wow. can you do that? Like it has.
I had not thought
of,
that. Just mind-blowing.
Yeah, there yeah. are all sorts of different implications for we need to treat archives and archival storage, especially for Indigenous communities, on country.
Wow.
Yeah, because I just think that the thought of taking our people
elsewhere
is heartbreaking.
Or even just even in that liminal ether space, like the cloud yeah. space as a, yeah, as like a they're space. Suspended in yeah. out there,
yeah.
like untethered.
It's like digital purgatory, it's terrifying.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was talking recently about the idea of emotional data and like so that totally I think fits into that, right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
it is this weird liminal, untethered, outer techie code space that is really not connected to anything on the land, any human, no. any living, like even, you know, wow. Yeah, that's a really big thing.
Yeah, it's kind
and the
of
ethics
terrifying.
Of that.
And the ethics of that. And I think it's like I know in Aotearoa at the moment they're trying to build more data storage.
Actually on country. Yeah,
on country. So in Auckland they're building data storage.
Wow.
So it is starting to happen and in other places in the Pacific they're trying and thinking about that more, not wanting their ancestors to be digitized and floating.
Totally.
Yeah.
Wow. I want to pick up the weaving thing because I know your practice most recently has really engaged with the act of weaving, but weaving photographs. So I just, yeah, whether it's as baskets or as cloak, yeah, tell us how you moved from, I guess, that those early diorama photos all the way into this very labor-intensive weaving.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, I guess when I went to art school, I know now it's different and there's a different type of glove that people wear, but back in my day we had little white cotton gloves.
I think I still have quite a number of somewhat soiled.
Somewhat soiled, yes. And it's that idea that your fingerprints will leave behind oils and other things on the surface of the photograph, so you protect them with the archival white cotton gloves. As a woman of colour, wearing those never felt comfortable because it just feels like I'm ready to do a mammy routine. So it just, they've got all sorts of horrible connotations for women of colour, domestic service, blackface, all sorts of stuff. So it's just like bleh. And so for me, on top of that too, in Māori culture, the way photographs are spoken to, they're lamented, they are treated as living beings. So when you have a tangi or a funeral, you bring out your old photos so that they can come to the funeral.
Wow.
So and they're touched physically. And I still remember the first time I went to the Auckland War Memorial and seeing Māori families on the weekend half climbing over stuff and touching things. And I had that really colonised mindset of like, you're in the museum, you don't touch anything. And it was great. And, it's, and at a moment I was like, oh, they're climbing on the, like, there are kids climbing on the. and then realising actually, of course they are. These are their ancestors and they're coming to visit their family on the weekend.
Wow.
And.
That's a beautiful idea, right?
Yeah.
Like just, it's, and it's. We can all understand that. We all know what it's like to go and see family and hug family and
hug family and want to touch with, and
yeah. Yeah, but that so, it's situated within these belongings
and needing that touch and being allowed to touch in the museum, I think is really important. So for me as a photographer, wearing the gloves never sat well, and then it was just like I want to be able to touch my own photographs. I want to engage with them physically, and it felt a bit naughty, which was kind of nice. So,
but also too, it's actually I think Because it's the same in conservation with materials and textiles. Mm. Like you're not allowed to touch, it has to be certain, because I did some studies within that. And it was really interesting to see the similarities in photography. But actually through human touch you're adding value. And I think that is what it, again, the further afield you have, like as museums and institutions like to do, or taking things away from their home country, putting them behind glass. But it's this kind of another version of colonization and protecting for your sake, you know, like let's make it civil. Like it's all that, it all for me, that's what it brings up.
Yeah, definitely.
And by not allowing you to touch them, to have your imprint, to have the oil or, you know, that, again, it's about keeping it, in inverted commas, clean.
Yeah, and
which is just awful, right?
Yeah,
it's just the undercurrent.
And it's inaccurate.
Correct, yes.
I mean, the British Museum.
Just awful.
Have got such an awful history, but the whole idea of them protecting objects, they don't even know what they have in their collection half the time. They've lost stuff. There was an inquiry 2 years ago into how much stuff they'd actually lost, and things have been stolen from the museum, from their archives. So they're not safekeeping.
No. No.
Yeah, so for me, I guess I had been working in photography, and then I joined a group called the Pacific Women's Weaving Circle.
Okay.
In about 2011.
Where's that located?
It's now morphed and turned into different weaving groups, but it was set up by Lisa Hilly and Marianne Talia Powell, who so a PNG sister and a Samoan sister, who were wanting to get Pacific women together to share and skill share and talk and eat and
and be right
and be,
just
yeah,
be
yeah
have a space for
yeah.
you guys
yeah and so I started weaving with them and just fell in love with it.
Wow.
Yeah. And kind of learnt from there on.
And so when did you decide that you were going to combine the weaving with the photographs?
I think for me it was the idea of how do I, as a Māori woman, as someone who's Indigenous, although not here, how do I deal with this product, the camera, when it's got such a heavy history with my own people. So it's been used as a colonial tool, as a kind of weapon, really. It's sexualized women the turn of 1900s, basically, turn of the 20th century. Postcards of Māori women were the most traded images in the world. So we were very heavily commodified.
Wow.
Often they came with inside photographers' jokes. So they would, for example, they'd have an image of a dark woman who was Māori wearing ceremonial clothing and then have her holding a lily. And it became quite a trope in these postcards. And it would say a Māori lily down the bottom, but the association being that a lily is often associated with purity and virginity and has been used in representations in art history.
Of centuries, the, right?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, Virgin Mary and things like that.
Yeah.
And the whole idea is you can't have a native woman who is innocent. And it's kind of like, and also the whiteness of the flower.
Yeah,
it's gross.
Oh, my God, it's really gross.
It's really gross.
On so many levels.
Oh, yeah. So there'd be things like that, or there'd be the passive reclining native
girl. Yeah.
But then they'd also do the thing where she's always holding a weapon, just so you don't forget she's a savage. Again, another kind of racist trope in a lot of these colonial photographs. So I guess for me what I wanted to do was to take, you know, this heavily loaded image of Māori women, and I only worked with photographs of women, and I only worked with photographs of women who were weaving.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the customary arts had been recorded because I felt I could relate to them
and
there was a one-on-one with them, and I didn't want a power dynamic even though I'm working with archival images.
Yeah.
And I started weaving photographs of Māori women who were weaving, and I did that for my master's while I was at RMIT. And part of it was trying to turn the flat surface of a photograph into an Indigenous object by weaving it in customary techniques. and Caspary Māori patterns. Mm-hmm. So, but the process itself is really labour intensive.
But you can do it sitting down, right?
I can do it sitting down. Exactly. I can do it sitting down.
Yeah.
And it can take hours, and they're traditional patterns, but often it can be like layering of four different photos at once.
Oh, my gosh.
Four different copies that have then been sliced, numbered, woven to get the right pattern. Yeah.
It's so intricate. I mean, they're beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
But I think that there's something, I'm going back to that idea of you physically touching and holding the photographs as you weave.
Yeah.
And it's because I think that's a really popular thing in Australia at the moment with the tapestry workshop where they, you know, they pick other artworks and then turn them into tapestries, which is beautiful, but it's a transposing of the original to where what you're doing is actually you're working with, I mean, yeah, the indexical, but then turning it into something completely unique through your own physical labour and traditional customary modes of, in the end, making something that has use.
Yes.
Right? Like I think, and its own spirit, you know, it becomes an ancestor too,
it
right?
Does.
Which is just a really beautiful transformation.
Thank you. Yeah. It's, for me, they have to be functional. And they have to be the right size in, so a cloak.
Yeah, you're not going to do it. You're not going to do it a miniature of it or a really massive version. You're going to actually make a wearable cloak. I think of the one that was at the NGV. Like it just, you could have stood in that.
Yes, I did.
Did you? I don't think I've seen that. Yeah, oh, no, very cool.
Yeah, I did. I managed to wear it. Yeah. Heavy, but
But also heavy to make, right?
Yes. Yeah, that was really complicated.
Like, is that, you know, the dining table out? Like, how do you, in the studio kind of like huge, right?
Huge in the studio. So I wove a customary cloak.
Wow.
Using, so it was a kahu huruhuru, and which means feather cloak. Mm-hmm. So I wove a cloak in a customary way. I was using modern materials though, so I didn't use, I used cotton.
Okay.
Which some weavers still do. Mm-hmm. Wove a cloak using customary methods, then photographed it, then in Photoshop divided it into overlapping photographs.
Oh my
gosh.
It
became 500 and something photographs. actually, it might be 457 photographs. And then they overlapped in about 14 different rows, and they were inserted in the same way that the feathers are inserted.
Okay, so that makes sense.
Yeah, I have a photo of my husband who had to, his job was to
hold it.
The top of the photo to then put a thread through so that the thread could be woven in. The look on his face is just like, poor man. Yeah.
And then let's talk about the baskets that you've been doing more recently.
Yeah, kite. So I was really thrilled to get a Creative Australia grant to travel to New Zealand and to photograph waterways that were important to my tribe and sub-tribe.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back New Zealand is one of the first places in the world that has ever named a river a legal person.
That's impressive.
Yeah. So it's my river hasn't been, mine's the Waikato, but the Whangarei River has been, and it's legally been given personhood. The Māori king, who is from my area, has talked about whether he wanted the Waikato River to be given personhood, and he was like, that's a Western European thing, we know it's an ancestor, we don't need that legal framework.
Interesting.
Yeah. So
do you feel mixed about that or in agreeance of that its spirit is already acknowledged within the community?
I think it is already acknowledged. I mean, it's kind of funny, like the idea of, like often I'll talk to, if I talk to white academics about a river being an ancestor legally or legally being given personhood, they're like, wow, that's incredible. And on one hand it is, but legally corporations have been given personhood as well. So that makes it less sexy instantly.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this is the reality of the world we're in terms of having responsibilities to other people. So by being given personhood, it means they're responsible or someone is responsible for them.
Yeah, okay.
Which is more of a Western framework.
Yeah.
So I'm in two minds. In one way, I think it's beautiful, but in another way, I'm like, but corporations have been given personhood too.
Yeah, and again, it doesn't actually, whether it's given or not, doesn't take effect. Take away the fact that it already has that anyway, right?
Is. Like that's so it's an ancestor.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's quite complex, isn't it? Really,
And it was kind of interesting for me. Like I can sort of have my Western academic hat on sometimes that I need to decolonize, and then I can have my Maori hat on sometimes. And I know when I was photographing it, like I can logically say, yes, I see this as an ancestor. But when my husband and I went to photograph in the Waikato, so it's quite a wild part of it. It was hard to get into.
Okay.
So it was one of the because the Waikato River has a lot of turns and twists. There was a phrase in Māori about for every turn of the Waikato River, there's a taniwha or water monster dragon.
Wow.
And it's a taniwha is also the name for a chief.
Oh,
so it's kind of like if you go up the river, you could get fucked up.
Yeah.
You know, because there's a chief around the corner. Yeah. It's sort of so it was very fertile, hard to get into, and a bit of a stronghold for a while of some of the Māori king movement, and still is the centre of the Māori. King is still based in Waikato. But anyway, I went there with my husband. We were in fairly dense bushland, and I was trying to photograph a stream that was right next to my tribal land and was part of my tribal land on a farm and walking through. And I had thought I had thought like a photographer, I'm photographing a landscape. I need wide angle.
It's all about the lens, right?
Yeah, it's all about the lens. And I needed to, you know, do this properly. And I didn't have, you know, I had some money to buy a good lens. And I was like, need a good wide angle lens, get the wide angle, like, right, got all the gear, got some other gear as well, half packed on my husband. And, we were trekking through the bush basically to photograph this stream near my, and this is where my ancestors would have fished. And
how beautiful.
And you could see even walking through the bush, there were spots where there were small caves and you could see fires, where fires had been burnt so that they would have had a fish and cooked up straight away and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, had my big fancy lens and I go to shoot the river, and every time I had that lens on my camera, it would overcast, crappy. I'd be around a corner thinking,
it's not doing anything.
And then I'd pull that off and went, I just wanted to swap lenses and try. I'd put on the portrait lens, and the river was like a cheeky auntie who's like, all right, girl, I'm ready for my close-up now. And was just like playing with me all day.
Wow.
And so every
time. What an amazing experience.
Oh, it was nuts. And just every time I attempted to pull the other lens. Clouds, everything, wind would come up, portrait lens. It's like, auntie wants a portrait. Okay. So, yeah.
Wow. But isn't that amazing? Like just that thing of the personality.
Oh, hugely.
Coming out and going, That's not my good side.
No.
Right?
Exactly. It was completely. And it wasn't until, like, and all over the Waikato we'd been trying to get. Couldn't get Wi-Fi.
Okay.
Or if our phones connected to anything. After trekking for 3 hours, we get to this spot at the bottom of a, it was a waterfall, and we're at the base of the waterfall, so we're surrounded by rocks and mountains. And I was like, oh, this is incredible, and I need to spend some time with this waterfall.
Mm.
My husband miraculously gets Wi-Fi. And he felt like it was the place going, all right, boy, you got her here. You sit down, you be quiet, you play with your little phone. We'll give you some internet and you let girl take some photos now, you know.
Yeah, check out. You've done your job.
Thank you and goodbye. Here's some internet for you, boy.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, so it was amazing.
I mean, that we'll get to then what you're doing with those photos, but just that experience, what an incredible thing to have. And really, like, frustrating, I'm sure, as it was. In reflection, be like, oh, I was guided. Like, completely. I was held in that space and directed. I even think about that thing of, like, the chief aspect of it, you know, the monsters. It's just like, we'll protect you, we'll keep you safe. You might not get all the things that you thought you were going to get.
Exactly.
But you will get something. We will gift you something.
Definitely. And it's that idea of a kind of listening and being with place that's that's different.
And those photos are beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and they do feel like they have personality and spirit.
It was quite a it was a sort of magical time, actually, to just spend time. And we had been, I'd gone to my marae and talked to a couple of uncles there who had told me where to shoot. And we'd kind of been guided the whole time by conversations and having my extended family, I guess, direct me where we should go.
Support you.
Yeah.
And so then transforming them into baskets. How did you decide to do that process?
Oh, it's horrible. The process is awful. It's really hard. It's really weird maths because Māori weaving raranga, which is the style of weaving the kite or baskets are woven in, rather than warp and weft, we use dextral and sinstral. So everything is at 45-degree angles. So having an image, I knew how to weave an image, but making the image appear and line up had to be, so normally you would take a photograph, but in order to make these I had to do weird sort of parallelograms and have them overlapping so that the central overlap place would read as a photograph so it would meet up.
Okay.
So the maths is actually.
And you're also doing it blind, right?
Yeah, so you weave up the basket and you can see it flat. When you join it, it's blind. You can no longer, because it becomes cylindrical, and the photograph is on the inside and you weave up so it's blind, and then you don't know what you're doing until you physically have to turn it inside out like it's a textile and like an item of clothing, which, again, with a photograph.
It's just really hard.
Yeah.
Like, it isn't a textile.
No, it's not a
textile. It's a paper.
It's a photograph. Yeah, and it's a shiny photograph. Like, I played around a lot with texture in doing tests.
Yeah.
And if I used a... You know, I'm a
Like a matte, beautiful a matte rag.
It didn't read like a photo at all. So I had to go for a Kodak gloss or semi-gloss.
Nice.
Yeah. A photo I would never, like, paper I would never read.
But I also think, isn't that telling you something really interesting? Because if you go back to that idea of function, right?
Yeah.
And the most accessible everyday photograph that we all understand is the Kodak gloss.
Kodak gloss.
You know, it cuts through everything.
Yeah.
It actually survives in really terrible archival conditions.
Yes.
I think of all those 80s photos, you know, where you stick them down.
Oh,
they're still okay.
They're still okay.
How?
Yeah.
How?
Crazy.
Everything else is brown.
Yeah.
They're still kind of okay. I mean, slightly, you know, saturated.
Yeah.
But it's the working every day. Mm-hmm. You're making a kite that is for use, for function.
Yes. Yeah. And it takes a few days to weave up. And I'm ruthless.
So you have like
with them.
Like the strongest forearms, right?
Yeah. The rest of me not so much, but yeah. But yeah.
And then the other thing that was really interesting in how you've displayed them a couple of different ways.
Mm.
Some as kind of the object in perspex, was it?
Or
perspex. But you can see them 360, which is lovely. And then others you've put on the wall. Is that from
So I had them installed. Yeah, I had them installed at Black Dot Gallery in a show called Exchange, and that was part of Yurrumboy Festival. And yeah, I had two displayed in acrylic wall-mounted boxes, and they were quite squished, as in the handles.
Yeah, you couldn't actually they weren't sitting and breathing. And,
No. And part of that, I actually really wanted this idea that. they did look compressed, as though the object is too large to be contained in that kind of a box.
It's a lovely metaphor.
Yeah. And I think, so I had two on a backdrop of a wallpaper.
Yeah.
That was a print taken of Kafia and I was, which is a beach. And so it's from the water looking out onto the beach, and that's the place where the Tainui Waka or canoe landed.
Okay.
So that was the landing place of my ancestors.
Wow.
So that was the same view they would have seen coming in, which for me was really important to have.
Yeah, and transporting through time and place, right?
Yeah, and so that was sort of what was anchoring all of these waterways in a kind of whakapapa or a genealogy. So that was the large kind of dominating piece. And I had two on the wall and then three in different I had made black acrylic. Well, I didn't make them. I paid for someone to make sort of acrylic cases, showcases for them to stay in.
Yeah, and they were the ones that you could walk around.
Yeah, you could walk all the way around them. And I like people being able to see inside and see the construction. And for me, it's important that other Māori weavers can read it.
Oh, nice.
So that there are kind of clues for the photographers and then clues for the weavers, kind of.
Yeah, that's really clever. Or like you, where that you could read both.
Yeah. Which I also kind of, one of my heroes, Maureen Launder, who was the first Māori to get a fine art PhD, had been a photographer. And then she went on to become, she's also a weaver.
So there's synergies there that you're kind of nodding to. Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
So what are you working on right now?
Right now I am still weaving up some other kite that were from, because I learnt a lot in the process of making, of what worked and what didn't. Because it's really hard to compose a image when you then have to think about
the mats
and you never know completely how it's going to turn out. So I feel like some images worked better than others in a kite form, and now that I've learned those lessons I'm sharpening.
Nice.
Because I'm obsessive, which I think you can tell from my practice. There's a bit of an uptight kind of
it's all about controlling the world.
Yes, it is.
Self within world.
Yeah, exactly.
I think there are certain things that we all kind of can bond over in those moments. It's like, oh, I'm obviously not in the actual, you know, I mean, I love the materiality, but like, yeah, the OCD aspect of like editing images for me.
Yes.
All of, like I've worked at, I'm really good at, you know, where's wallet, like those terrible, you know, like finding because I can notice, or puzzles where you notice the change in tone.
Yep.
And it's like, oh, I'm obsessive. This is probably not healthy.
No, I think it's healthy. But for a photographer, it's really
well, it makes
healthy.
Sense. It's actually and really useful.
Exactly, yeah.
But also, yeah, I think that attention to detail, that it does, you can tell in the final. Like I'm probably one of those people that, and I blame it on my textile background, but, you know, you buy a garment and you want the zip to work.
Yes.
Right? And you want to be able to wash it and be able to wear it again and again and again. Yeah. But if the zip doesn't work or it is disfigured in the washing, that's terrible craftsmanship.
Oh,
and it doesn't matter how pretty it looked or how conceptually brilliant it was.
Mm.
If I can't wear it, it's redundant.
Yeah.
And I think with, you know, again, that's a very crude example, but bringing it across to photography, you have to be a master of the form and the technique, and you have to take pride.
And I love the fact that you use the word craftsmanship, because I think that's key. There is craftsmanship in photography. I think sometimes we're so image exposed with everyone now having literally a
phone at their on their hand, as an extension.
That and we're used to being oversaturated by images.
Totally.
That even more there is a need for craftsmanship within photography. Of there is a reason why it is an art form, and I love seeing craftsmanship in photography.
Me too. To have that wonder of a beautiful photograph.
Yeah.
You know, that, and it isn't just a technical exercise.
No.
It's so much more than that.
Yeah.
And they're the images that go in.
Yeah.
But also I think that idea of creating the unique state is something that we are further and further away with because of technology, yes. right? So yeah. transforming it into a cloak, into a woven piece, into a kite, like all of a sudden you're creating potentially another ancestor, but also that deep core understanding that everything is individual.
Yes.
And that has a spirit and has its own sense of being in its authentic self, yep. I think is a really beautiful thing to transfer into, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And we miss that, I think, in our very image-heavy, saturated life.
Yeah. And I think it's that thing too of the hand being in it.
Mm.
Like I like being able to see someone's hands having made something. And I've had, it was funny, like when I remember with the NGV work, and it was all done by hand by me. James, my husband, but that was kind of it. And then I'd had assistance with the customary cloak.
Okay.
With family members bundling feathers for me and things like that. But not in the actual weaving. So all the weaving was mine.
It's you.
And in the photographic version, that was all me. But when when it got accepted by, so it was commissioned and acquired by NGV, and when I was talking to their registrar, they were like, oh, okay, so is this an addition?
Oh.
And it's like, oh, God, no.
No.
No, I'm not
making mine ever again.
No, but also like, but how could it be? Like I was kind of confused by the question because I thought.
But do you think it's because it's that classic photography question?
Mm.
You know, the addition. The addition, Wow, no, it's like, no, this is well and truly a unique piece.
This is
beyond any.
Yeah.
And you couldn't replicate, actually.
No.
And that's the most beautiful thing about it.
Exactly.
Or any, and I guess it goes back to the original cloak idea. They are all individual, like none were the same.
No.
It's not a factory line.
No, exactly. And they show, like I remember hearing from a weaver who was weaving a ceremonial cloak and then a loved one passed and they could see in the stitches because they kept weaving through that time and it had been meant to be for them and then they never got to receive it and they had to keep weaving and it ended
and
up.
And it changed.
Yeah, and it changed. But they could see the stitching in the middle where they were going through grief. And I love that idea of whether we mean to or not, we imprint
ourselves
in these and what we're going through, in what we're making. So, and I like that. I like even having the idea of, like, in one way I'm a massive perfectionist.
Yeah.
And then there are times when the paper does tear.
So like, I can only, like, the horror, I mean, right?
They're swearing. the language level goes up a notch, but, it's not fun.
Yeah.
And especially when you've printed and you've woven and then you've got, because one centimetre strip would mean the entire photograph has to be reprinted. And because I wanted fenu that were, or like strips, strips that were a metre long to be long enough, the print with a metre long 45 degree angle means that the paper is even bigger.
Wow.
So like one little boo-boo and...
You start again.
Yeah, you start again and,
And you ask for whatever your favourite food or anything is to be given.
You either start again or you decide actually it's part of the work.
Okay, lovely, Because it's real, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Thank you so much. This has been such a great conversation. I have so many more questions, but I figure for the time, we've covered a lot. I also feel like the things that you produce or speak to in your work and that idea of imprinting ourselves is such an important idea to hold on to. Because as artists, researchers, however, you know, but just as on a human level, I think that is, if we go right back to where we started, that gift of translating story for everyone.
Yep.
And in a way giving a bit of yourself to everyone to then gift back, explain, encourage, but also I guess speak to your ancestors.
Yeah.
Especially for you.
Yeah.
You know, I think if you have a deep connection to your blood, your country, the spirit of which. And I was recently learned about the idea of the Va. And I just, you know, the water, like the, it's all relational. We're all in the same water. Yeah. I think that is such a beautiful, beautiful idea. And it kind of makes being an artist, I think, so noble and so worthy. But that also you recognize it in all aspects of our culture and our life.
Yeah, definitely.
And I feel like that is at the center of all of your work.
Oh, thank you. I hope so. I try to make the ancestors proud, I think. I'm just, yeah.
I'm sure they will be.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks.
Out of the Frame is supported by RMIT University Press Play Studio, is produced by Pia Johnson, music by Steph O'Hara, and graphic design by Brent Leadovitz.